Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and has been broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans, as well as Bristol. This week, Naya and Habakkuk from St Paul's talking about the carnival. Also, Ian, who's been homeless, living in his car now for over a year. Also, predictive programming. We talk to Jay from Jay's Analysis in the States about what that means, television programmes that seem to predict the future. Also, 9/11 Truth in Mid Wales. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio, one word, .co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. Call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk, and I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But we start this week with Naya and Habakkuk from St Paul's. Hi, and welcome to Dialect.
All right, greetings.
Now, have I pronounced Habakkuk right? Because that's the way it's spelled.
Yes.
Yeah, I have. Oh, that's good.
Well, yes, it's a part of the scripture, the Holy Scripture. You know, it was basically, it's a family descendants from Niger.
From Niger?
From Niger. Yes.
I mean, maybe we could start by asking you both if you've managed to trace your family history back and how far you have managed to do that.
Well, I done that because of my grandmother and my grandfather's. See, so I traced my grandmother, father, back to Niger. The days of when the British went into Niger and annihilate and taking people out where the slave trade begins.
So that's via Jamaica or somewhere, is it?
Well, via Jamaica. Comes out of, wind up in the slave trade.
What about you, Naya?
Well, my name, I have traced both sides of my name, and my surname, to be frank, it's Hollingsworth. And I did on UK Ancestry, I did a search, and that name went back to Liverpool. And as history teaches us, Liverpool was like one of them slave ports, like where they would transport slaves. But on the other side, being a Rastafarian, I trace my roots back to Ethiopia, really, where life all began. That's where everything goes back for me.
So how do you go about becoming are you born into being Rastafarian, or how does someone become one, and what does it really mean? Because you must be, I suppose, from some sort of tradition somewhere in the world. And I'm assuming, did you just say Ethiopia?
Yes. You see, it's all about a consciousness, you know, because that's what was here first, the highest consciousness. That's why we're all here, right? But it started in Ethiopia. And from there, the first man created himself, because we are all here today. But there was someone else before us, right? So it started from one mind, the most advanced mind in the universe, that created all of this. Because the Big Bang story has too many holes in it. You know, for me, that carries no
black
water.
Black holes.
Well,
whatever hole they want to call it.
You know? So I trace the beginning to Ethiopia, where it all began from, this consciousness.
Tell me what it means to be Rastafarian. What do Rastafarians believe? Is it connected with biblical tradition?
No, it's not about really biblical tradition. Like I say, it's the highest consciousness. I mean, awareness, like I would say, I study people just to understand and comprehend or overstand, as we say, why they do the things they do, why they behave the way they behave. And I realize that in our minds, there's two sets of thoughts, good and evil. Right? Now, this is the consciousness I'm talking about.
Are you talking about, say, almost like imagine the cartoon with an evil spirit on one shoulder and a good spirit on the other shoulder, both telling you different things, and you listen to one, you listen to the other, but you're not quite sure necessarily which way to go?
But that's where the individual know. You have to show that's where your true character is showed up. What are you, you know? What sort of person you are? Which side of these thoughts are you going to represent? Because we are all capable of doing good, and we are all capable of doing evil. Isn't it so?
Yeah, I'm sure you're right. But right? Isn't it sort of more to do with whether people are selfish or public-spirited? That's another, you know, different way, paths people can take, isn't it?
Yeah, but the thing is, it still come back to your mind is your control center, just like the engine is the control power of the car. And you have the, what have you, all the other accessories, your steering wheel, your gear and all of that, like. But our minds as people, we are governed by our minds. But a lot of people are so materialistic in thought. They just see themselves as the container, just the body. But we are more than a body. We have a mind, man. We are the highest species on the planet. And we are the lowest at the same time, because man, as we have seen time and time and time again, mankind can be so low, yet still mankind can elevate himself to levels that marvels us and do things that marvel us.
So do you also trace your ancestry back through the Caribbean?
That's just, you see, how we all know through slavery, that's how we ended up in the Caribbean. Right? But life didn't begin for us with slavery. There was life before slavery.
So tell me a bit about Ethiopia as a country, because, I mean, for a start, a lot of people don't even necessarily know where it is. It's just south of the Middle East. I think it's on the east side of Africa. As you're traveling down the east side of Africa, you come to Ethiopia, am I right?
Ethiopia is just close to Somalia, Eritrea, and it's there, just below Kenya.
Okay.
You know, so it's on the eastern side, really.
And tell me, have you ever been to Ethiopia?
No,
what's,
I've
you
ever never, I've never been there. Okay.
Well, you see, the whole point is with Ethiopia is the central point of Africa. The central point is the highest point of the world itself. The highest point of all Africa. See, so within where one was created and one was found. You know, before, you know, all this destruction went into Africa.
I know, because Africa, I think for many people, they look at it as a place that has gone through a terrible time with the colonial era, and now it's another kind of colonial era with the IMF and the financial way that the African countries have so-called been given their independence, but then they're in the clutches of the moneylenders, the debt. And then
Well, basically, within, as far as I can see, and within the money business, it's not, you see, because what the Europeans done is to take away bartering and give us this pluck, the thing what we call pluck. You see, the money, what you look on with a head and whatever they want to put on it, it's a pluck. It's a wall of a sign that put on a wall for who represent where. See, beginning, if we go back to the Roman time, they had a plaque, and the plaque is made out of metal.
Well, the thing is, the IMF, they just like, they have just taken over, and from the slavery to colonialism, and now it's just like economic slaves. And they have destroyed a lot of country. That's all the IMF is there to do. It's not to help to build a country. There's no country that has like experienced the IMF and left standing on its legs. And that's how these people operate. These like
criminals.
They're criminals. Really.
They are criminals.
You know, if the law was really, if there was justice in the law, the so-called international laws and laws of the land, no one couldn't usurp they couldn't navigate themselves away.
So how does Bristol fit into all of this? You know, a city we live in, we broadcast from. What's Bristol's place in the world these days?
What's Bristol's place? Just like any other place, it's been controlled and exploited as well, because the people in Bristol, they get up and they go to their jobs, and they are just economic slaves as well. I mean, I have done that myself. I did, the last job I had was 12 years on the Portbury docks. So I was locked into that program as well. Though it's a means of surviving, right? But I had to do that. I gave my body to that, but my mind was, I still kept my mind. I didn't give my mind over to the
work. I thought that they only used great big cranes on the Portbury docks to move containers around. There was hardly any. I mean, a lot of the old industries that people used to be employed in have now been mechanized, haven't they?
Yes.
And you see, that's a part of the exploitation again. You see, which way, you know, the human strength is not making enough money. So they bring in the cranes, you know, what we call the robots. They bring in the robots, you see. So they put, you know, they use you over the years, then put you on the, well, we call it the scrap heap.
Well, it's a bit, maybe a bit like the migrant crisis, is that they're seeing thousands, tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of people now as surplus to requirements.
Well, it's just like the goods they make, surplus to requirements, down on the docks, if I can continue. I used to like do a bit of driving down there, right? And these cars, they just keep coming, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of them, so they are just mass producing these things.
You can see them, can't you? If you go on the bridge on the M5.
Avonmore Bridge, yeah. And you look down. You see them there. They have these contracts whether with Nissan, Vauxhall, Fiat, you know, whoever. And they just keep sending these cars and these ships, they keep coming over with thousands upon thousands of cars.
But that's because we keep buying them.
But I mean, look on the streets. Even the motorways, they are like side streets nowadays. They are like the high streets. You like it's bumper to bumper. I know you have experienced it. We all have. You know, so
it's a bit of an obsession with the car, isn't there? There seems to be, anyway. Getting rid of buses or making them difficult or whatever. Anyway, let's move and talk a bit about what's been going on in St. Paul's, because there's been some big changes in the last few months. Really the end of 2015, beginning of 2016, with the mayor deciding, first of all, that he has no confidence in the people running the St. Paul's Carnival. He's told them that. As to have the police, and the same sort of thing going on with the Malcolm X Centre. Now, what are your thoughts, locals, about it? Because, I mean, sometimes, you know, even I'm sure you would admit that sometimes things aren't well managed enough and someone has to do something about it. So I just wonder what your thoughts are, whether that's just what the mayor's been doing with the carnival and the Malcolm X.
Well, to start with... anything that involves money, you have to be really, you know, careful, because a lot of people, they are devious in their doings, and, you know, it comes from their thoughts again, and they have ulterior motives. But my thing is, if you're going to keep an event, a concert, festival, what have you, you first organize your music. Now, St. Paul's is a cultural event which showcases like Caribbean cultures, really, right? And most of the islands, they share a thing called music. So if I was like going to plan the carnival, right, my music would be the first thing, because everything is happening around the music. Now, to return to your question, what I think about what's going on, these people, they organize their thing around money. And anytime money come into anything, you find this all these disagreements, and this one want to go that way and that way. And, you know, it causes a lot of craziness. You know, the disagreements. I mean, people can disagree because everybody have their views and all of that. But their disagreement is hampering, you know, something that should be... cherish and valued for the people, because those who did it before, these people in charge, they did it with very little money, and no, because money, the commitment was there. And recently we watched a video in Malcolm X and how they started and all of that, and they just went around with their hats and collect a few pennies here and there. But I know the thing has grown and it has become too commercialized now, and people just, they're focusing more on the commercial side of it than the actual event itself and what it really stands for. It's just one day we have in the hero we can showcase our culture, and you know, turn up the sound system and make a bit of noise. Because that's how these systems like to play. They're heavy systems and they should be given a time to play, man. Play out on the streets and entertain the people and not just entertain them. Because the music carries a message as well. You know, you just pump it out loud.
Well, what I see with St. Paul's Carnival over the years, been around Bristol here, there and everywhere. Basically, I'm a singer-songwriter myself, and I've been around Bristol since I can remember. With the carnival, again, it's, as Naya say, it's concentrate on where you want to go with this culture. We have got children. You know, the children like to grow up and to see what we done in the past. You see, and I notice nowadays it's sort of been taken out bit by bit and here, there and everywhere they put it. And for planning, you got to sit down and plan these things properly. You can't just plan it overnight. You finish it today, tomorrow you wake up, you continue the planning. It's not something you stop and start. That's why I find with St. Paul Carnival is stop and start, and everyone, I've got something else to say. And that, as you see when we watched that film at Malcolm X the other day, and you can see that gentleman when he said that where he started it and how he started it. That's true. And basically, we never get nothing from the council. I've been there, so I know what he's saying. You know, these are the thing is, you see, but money is a dangerous influence in culture. In culture, when you come up with culture thing, because everybody else have got an idea.
Well, if I was the mayor, you know what I'd be saying? I'd be saying, well, the event's got so big, we need to make sure that there's some kind of security, maybe private security, and that costs money.
Yes, but you see, as I say, it's the planning. Whoever's planning it, you finish it today. For next year, you start it tomorrow. You see, and it's an ongoing thing. And with what the mayor said, yes, he got a point. You see, because it's a stop and start. All he's seeing is a stop and start. And this gone missing, that gone missing. So the point is for who is beyond it, running it, is to pull the rein in and said, okay, let's sit down and do a new strategy.
Well, there's going to be no carnival, apparently, this year, 2016. I mean, I would imagine that there will be a little bit of music.
Well,
even without the official carnival.
Even if we are offered like a bit of time to play the music. Yeah, we are grateful for that. You know, and that's personally speaking, that's all I'd like the day to do. Because, you know, yeah, some people like the costumes, dress up and all of that. But tell you what, man, it's time we just pay attention to the music. The world we live in is a dangerous place. I don't see, we don't have no time to really jump around and dress up and joke around today. You know, because just today, coming here, I heard a story, a brother killed a brother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's the sort of world we live in. 2 days ago, Monday morning, I woke up and a lady in Moscow, she had a child, the head of a four-year-old child, so... The world is a dangerous place. We see the migrant crisis. We see all sorts of things. And we are fortunate we don't have no bombs dropping on our heads. Yet still BBC can put a program on the telly about the Russians are coming and all that. Listen, people are only concerned about the bills that are coming in their homes. Nobody's worried about no Russians coming here. And BBC need to stop them propaganda. You know, we have had enough of that, man. We had enough of all of them things.
Talking about the bills, do you think that's because St. Paul's is quite known as one of the poorer areas in Bristol. Do you think that's a real problem down the streets?
Well, not down the streets. At the moment, everybody is really facing it because this austerity where money is being diverted from the poorest communities, right? The hospitals have been privatized. In fact, everything has been privatized. I mean, banks own the hospitals now. What kind of craziness is that? You know? And then now, I saw something. My thing is, when I heard the date of the referendum the other day, something came to my mind. I remember Greece. The Greeks voted overwhelmingly, right, to their referendum was to not negotiate to the banks. And the Greek prime
that's
minister.
That's right. I mean, they voted in Syriza, the party, who said they would not negotiate. They said that they'd had enough of austerity. Yeah.
And did they accept what the people's will? Nah, they went against it. So my thing is like.
Well, they would say just a minute, because they would say that it would have meant that the whole country would have collapsed if they'd have said to the European Central Bank, no, we've had enough of you, that there would just have been no money in the country, and they weren't prepared to go back to the old currency or whatever. They weren't able to do that.
Well, they looted the country just as they did Cyprus before that. We know these criminals with their bail-ins. We know their doings. We're paying attention. We are not being like the sheeple who keep just walking blindly and not paying attention. We are this generation who pay attention. We are not like the sheeple who just think about sports and shopping and parties and all of that. You have some of us here who have woken up, man, and we're paying attention to what's going on.
What about the Malcolm X Centre, though? Because this is, I mean, it's a very highly charged name, isn't it? Malcolm X was a very interesting kind of character and a political figure in the United States. And it's important, isn't it, to keep that, you know, as true to his name, I suppose.
I wouldn't see him as a political figure. I would just see more somebody who was fighting for justice. And I don't know how fighting for justice can be political. You know, some people just deem that everything is political. Personally, I don't think political. I think conscious, because political thinking is what's causing the problem here in the world today. All these so-called political thinkers, all these so-called highly educated intellectuals, look at the state of the world, and it's all through them. And, you know, you can see from their actions, life is not really valued. But in some respects, I see incompetence on some people's part regarding running after Malcolm X. I don't care if they want to agree or disagree with me. I'm not looking no friend, I'm just talking the truth. You know? Because those who did the thing before, run the carnival, right? They did it without the involvement of the council. Now the thing is left down to the council. How the hell did it get to the point that the council is dictating to us what we should and should not do? They should be cooperating, not dictating.
Well, the council can dictate, because the council, for a start, is actually officially council property. So they will decide we're going to give a lease or not. The council can do that. And the same with the funding for the carnival. Yes. At the end of the day, the council can say, oh, well, we're not happy. We're not going to pay.
Yes, the council, look, I work around the council, and I work with council. I develop. I went into my pocket and I spent 30 grand building a recording studio for a youngster within a community. And yet, at the end of the day, you know, somebody come back to me and said to me that the council thinking of taking over. And I said, take over what? The studio belongs to me. And these are the little things. Now, with Malcolm X, I can remember when Malcolm X been the building been start to preserve back into the community. And as Naya say, it's people who comes in and have different ideas. Because when it started, and with the carnival and every little thing within the community, it was running peacefully. Everything was going. But you got the left end telling the right hand where to go, and the right hand telling the left hand, no, this is where we're going. You see, with Malcolm X, it's a scale which was very, at the moment, is unbalanced, and it's coming from both sides, from the council to the people within the community.
Yeah, man.
It's a council and the community. You see, greed is a thing where, you know, you cannot be greedy by spreading culture.
Okay, but it's okay for the council to step in if it's being run badly. Do you think it is?
Well, the council don't want to see it run badly. And the community don't want to see it run badly. But it's the ideology what's behind it. You see, it's like you have a door and you keep opening the door. When you keep slamming, it's going to drop off one day.
So what I'm trying to pin you down here and say, is it right for George Ferguson and the city council to come in and say, actually, we don't think you're running it right. We want these people or different people to be running it.
Well, tell you the truth is, the council want to put their own people in there to run it. And this is a facts and figure of the old ideology. I work with council, sorry to say it to the public, I'm uneducated. So which way uneducated fools do not understand education. And this is where the council is coming with their little, you know, little bits and pieces here. But what I'm saying, the council is to blame and part of the community is to blame. It's, as I say, it's greed on both sides.
So do you think the change is going to be for the better?
It would be for better, but as I say, the council going to find this 2016 without a carnival, what are they going to do? Send the police out again?
I don't see it getting from bad to worse, just like everything else. You know, because we attended a meeting recently at the Malcolm X Center where they had the screening for the beginning of all the old carnival started and everything around it and all of that, like, and everything has moved so far away from it. And like I said earlier, it's become too commercial and it's just business now, and it's like any other business. Some people in business, people want a profit, and that's the bottom line. It's all about business, the culture. And that has been like pushed aside, and you know, it's just been like exploited, like the people, and you know, unfortunately, that's the state of affairs today.
Do you think that that carnival is something that can translate from a sort of Caribbean Jamaica culture into the middle of Bristol?
Well, so you look, it become a European thing. Look at Notting Hill Carnival. Yeah, look at Notting Hill Carnival. It's two of my cousins and another friend who started this thing by his motor mechanic shop. He every so, you know, bring out on the holiday peak, and he brings out his sound system with the rest of the guys. He got a couple of singers come out, and then it grows from there. And for this, you get the police involved. You get all the local people involved. You see, so it's the same as with Bristol. It could become the same thing, but tell you the truth is, I don't think Bristol City Council want it to be here because of all the 1960 riots and the this and the that. You know,
I mean, surely the carnival is the opposite of the riots. This is people getting together, having fun and enjoying themselves, and actually having the police around just to make sure, you know, actually to build relationship with the police.
Yes, I agree with that. But if you see where it's going now, it's going back to the riot days, because there's no carnival, and the youngsters, they start playing, because at the moment there's no music supposed to be going out on the street, because that's been out there saying, you know, anyone that on that day, you know, it's so these are the little corners.
Do you think there's a feeling then that you know, there's a kind of suppression of the culture in St Paul's at the moment with the because several years there's been no carnival. You know, it's getting almost as if you know, you're not allowed to do it.
Well, basically, this is what I'm saying. You see, it's a suppression. It's a suppression. It's a serious suppression. And as I say, I cannot read and write. I'm basically uneducated, so I would like the educated one within the council and in the community to come up with something fast and quick. So the young people who was out there enjoying building their knowledge and these kind of area where to go. It's a cultural thing. It's a cultural thing for the black and for the white. See, so which way, when you take it away from the young people, what are you going to do?
And it's amazing, isn't it? Carnival attracts people from all over this part of the country, even down from Birmingham. Some even come from London.
You got people from America.
Yeah,
amazing. You got people from Russia. You got people from Germany. You got people from all over the world that comes to St. Paul's Carnival because it's a thing what been advertised all over the world.
I mean, you'd hope the police would bend over backwards, Naya, to make it happen.
That's what I'm... So anything that brings people together, instead of supporting it and promoting it, they try their best to suppress it, and it's cancelled and all of them things like... What, something like this, it should be an annual event. They should make sure it happens. Because it's... you'll find... The odd idiot who decides that he wants to have a fight with his enemy instead of just letting things slide on that day just to see the event, because it benefits us all. Like we know, people come from east, west, north and south. It's the power of music. It brings people together. The Glastonbury Festival.
You know, right?
It shows the power of the music.
Okay, so just to wind up, maybe each of you would just like to say what kind of vision you have for the future for St. Paul's, for the city, for the carnival, for Malcolm X. Have you got a kind of vision?
Well, my vision is for Malcolm X and also the carnival is to basically... the educated one sit down and start think about what they're going to do with the youngsters, how they're going to start the youngsters out. So it goes for the council, so it goes for the police. And the chief commander of Avon and Somerset, I am calling to him, to get something around the table. You know, and I say get it around the table and sit down with the community and Malcolm X and... also the council as well, get around the table and start sit down and getting these things together, because young people will suffer.
Well, and also if he doesn't, the pressure starts to build, doesn't it?
Build, that's yeah. The kettle start boiling.
And I would say to both the council and to the community, follow what we have, man. You know, our ancestors and our elders, our parents, grandparents, they made a lot of effort to get this thing going. You know, why should we just sit down now and throw it away or give it away? If you don't value the thing, you're going to lose it. It's like we have the saying, everybody know from the Caribbean, especially Jamaica, the cow never know the use of his tail until he loses it. Are we going to wait until we lose the carnival, then we realize what we had? Please don't let it come to that. It's going to be a sad mess.
Well, Naya and Habakkuk, it's a real privilege to have you on Dialect this week. Thanks very much for joining
us. Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Blessed love.
One love.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
And I'm joined now by Ian, who's been living in his car. It's just over a year now, Ian, isn't it?
Yep.
Just for those that haven't heard you before, how come you're still living in your car, even though you've got actually quite a lot of money? Because you sold, was it your mother's house?
I sold my mum's park home. The money was divided between me, my brother and my sister.
So you're not short of cash,
no.
But you haven't been able to get anywhere to live?
No, it's what I've said to you in the past. It's landlords seem to pick and choose who they want to live in their properties, and if your face or your name don't fit, then you don't get a property.
So what's your car like then?
Cold.
Especially this time of year, I'm sure, yeah.
It was -4 the other night.
How do you manage, actually, you know, with all the basic stuff like washing, that kind of thing?
Well, what I've been doing, I've been going into lorry truck stops and washing, but there's so many homeless people living in their cars now that they're slowly clamping down on people using facilities that they're not really entitled to use. Same as in the public swimming pools.
Well, hang on, the public swimming pool, if you pay to go for a swim, surely that's fine.
Yeah, I know. They're clamping down on...
Clamping down on people going swimming?
Clamping down on people allegedly going swimming and that actually going in, using the shower and then coming straight out.
Right. What about the police's attitude? Have they, has it got any better? Because I know you've been being hassled by the police.
No, the police are still the same. You know, they come round allegedly at 2 o'clock in the morning, checking on my well-being.
What, waking you up, saying,
waking
how are
me
you?
Up. Yeah, you know. It's, I'd like to go round to some of their houses when they're off duty and wake them up at 2 o'clock in the morning and see how pleased they are to see unwanted guests.
Is it the same police each time
doing
this?
It's the same police, yeah. It's the same. It's, they're all from the new super police station they've got at,
is
on the
A38. Up at Patchway?
Yeah, yeah. You know, surely, you know, there's a, where I park up, there's a car been abandoned since October. They're too busy harassing me to move, to do anything about this car, even though I reported it to the police. All they seem to be interested in is giving me a hard time because I'm sleeping in the car.
Did they say any give you any reason why you shouldn't be sleeping in your car?
No, the one of their favourite excuses is, we've had a report of a suspicious car parked up in this area. Well, I've been in the same spot for over 12 months now, so I don't know what is a suspicious spot and what is not a suspicious spot.
So over a year now living in your car, I mean, this isn't the sort of thing most people expect to do. How have you coped?
I've got the support of some good friends, loyal friends who have been my friends for 30-odd years. You know, they support me. They've got a lot of my expensive stuff in storage. So, you know, without their support, I think I'd be jumping off a bridge.
What about, you know, this whole business of trying to get somewhere to live? Have you had any attempts recently to get landlords to persuade landlords to...
I had a viewing in a property for two... There was six people or... Two couples and four single people went to view these two properties. And the guy asked me, how long have I been homeless? I said, 10 months. And he said, that's too long for my liking.
And apparently, according to the Bristol Post, it's okay to be homeless and you can still get yourself a job.
Yeah, apparently there was an article in last week's Evening Post saying that there's more homeless people than ever living in their cars and still holding down a full-time job. A lot of members of gyms sleep in their cars, go to the gym, have a shower, then go on to work. You know, you've got laundrettes, that do washing. You know, I go to a laundrette once a week, they do my washing, I go back, collect. So what I do is I rotate my washing. So I've always got washing in the laundrette. You know, you've got 24-hour dry cleaners. So if you've got a smart suit, you can go in, get it pressed.
So it's amazing, isn't it? Yeah, humanity is kind of almost like evolving into something which is okay to live in your car.
Yeah, yeah. It's like it seems to be the done thing, you know.
I mean, has it done your head in for the last year at all?
It's not done my health much good. I've got a problem with me left leg that I've told you about, but that's getting worse. And I've also now, because of two incidences where the police kicked me, I'm now in danger of being crippled for life because the heel injury I've got. You know, one more heavy kick on my foot and I might be disabled for the rest of my life.
Do you get any help? Welfare payments or whatever for this?
All I get is JSA, and at the moment they're trying to stop it. There seems to be any excuse now, the job centre will stop your benefit.
What excuse are they using with you?
They're trying to get me to go back to a European fund called CTEC, which is to help the long-term unemployed get back to work. I went there last year, and due to two job opportunities in a different area in the country, I phoned CTEC and told them, I'm not coming to your induction today. I'm going to these job interviews and some flats in Bury St Edmunds in Suffolk. Because I couldn't remember the name of the companies, they stopped my benefits for a month. Now, being diabetic, I have to eat on regular, like every 4 to 5 hours. So not having my JSA coming in every 2 weeks, luckily I appealed against, I got a hardship payment after proving that I am diabetic. And so luckily, while they CTEC were gloating that they'd stopped my benefit, you know, I could have died because of this judgment that they said that I didn't go to the job interview.
The thing is, they've got targets, haven't they? And yeah, they get bonuses for getting people off the benefits. Yeah. This is something rather sick about that, to think that, you know, someone can be deprived of what things they need to live, and then someone is given a financial cash payment as a reward.
Yeah.
Absolutely disgusting. Anyway, let's talk about nicer things. You're an avid plane spotter, plane watcher, photographer. The F-35, this is the Lightning plane that Britain has now ordered 138 of. George Osborne has just upped his order, even though the US Department of Defense is saying, actually, we don't want as many of these things because we're not quite so confident that they're any good. Some people are calling it the scam jet. What do you make of this jet? It's an absolute top of the range, supposedly.
It's a pile of rubbish. It really is. It's a $1 trillion black hole in the United States defense budget. In fact, one of the presidential candidates, Donald Trump, has said it does not make good business sense to buy the aircraft, and if he was president, he'd cancel it.
Well, the Department of Defense has done something close to that, but it seems our own George Osborne is picking up the slack.
The trouble is, there's so many countries. You've got different countries on different levels of F-35 procurement. The Canadians are talking about pulling out and cancelling their 91 F-35s. That will put the cost of every F-35 that George Osborne's bought up by £1 million. So that'd be an extra £148 million we've got to pay for our F-35s.
What I've heard is that up till 2020, that these aircraft, the actual cost of them to keep them going until 2020, including the purchase price, is something like £150 million each.
It is an expensive toy.
The whole programme is going to be something like £20 billion. Do you think they'll actually ever buy them?
I think we're going to buy them. I don't think they're going to be as good as what Lockheed Martin claimed.
But they might be, in fact, they are likely to be pretty much the only thing we've got.
No, we're going to have half the Royal Air Force is going to be Typhoons and the other half are going to be F-35s. That's all.
Okay, they've got to be half of everything we've got.
Yes. And don't forget, with two carriers, you're going to have a whole squadron of 10 aircraft permanently away at sea.
Well, let's hope they work anyway.
I can't see it.
Neither can I, to be honest with you. Also, the B-52s in Spain. Have you spotted those online?
No, they went into Spain on Sunday over the weekend. They're there apparently on the NATO exercise, but the Defence Department has announced that they were using B-52s against ISIS. So
they're going to take it in turns with the Russians, are they? We'll have B-52s one day and the Russians the next day.
I just wish the Russians would get out of the way and let the coalition get on with doing what they're good at.
Well, you might say that, but I think it was 3 years the coalition had to do something about ISIS and failed. And so the Russians have come in September, October last year, and since then,
Russians are a bigger hazard than the Russians are more.
Well, no, hang on a minute, just let me finish, because ISIS is actually on the back foot now. It's really running scared, and they've taken out their command
because
centers.
Because the Americans have finally deployed the A-10 Thunderbolt.
But why didn't they do that in the first place?
Because the man in the White House wouldn't deploy them. If you're trying to buy the F-35 program, you need to replace older equipment. So by scrapping the A-10 fleet, which is what Mr. Obama wanted to do and failed, what he wanted to do was shut down the A-10 program. But with the A-10's role, what's going to do it? You've got no aircraft that can do the job that the A-10 can do. It's got that great big GAU Avenger cannon at the front. And that is ISIS's biggest scare.
Do you see us edging towards a new Cold War, a fight, actual fight with the Russians in Syria?
No. The Russians can't afford to fight us in Syria.
Fight us?
Fight us.
So you think we...
The Russians...
That's more like a hot war, isn't it? Really,
yeah, the Russians are bombing everything in Syria that this President Bashar is telling them to bomb. He's bombing ISIS. He's bombing every opposition...
Well, I mean, it is his country after all, isn't it?
Yeah, but the trouble is, if the Americans and the British and the rest of the coalition are bombing just ISIS targets and the Russians are getting in the way, you're going to have blue-on-blue incidences.
What's that, Tory-on-Tory?
No, friendly fire.
Maybe you could put a few Conservative people in those planes.
Put George Ferguson in the ISIS target.
You're not a fan of the mayor? I think we're okay to talk about that since we're not
About George Ferguson.
Tell us a bit about George then.
I think he's an idiot. I don't think he knows. His policies seem to be what he wants for Bristol. Not what we want for Bristol, what he
and
wants
what does
for
he
Bristol.
Want? What does he want?
He wants a road where a car has to drive down the road at 20 miles an hour. And every cyclist can go whizzing past, doing 30 miles an hour plus, going down a hill.
So have you had a few scrapes with cyclists?
I've had a few near misses, yes.
Overtaking you?
Yes, it's a bit embarrassing. It's a bit embarrassing driving down.
I mean, a lot of people like the way that George is doing that because it's basically, it's number one, it's safer, less pollution.
Yeah, but he's concentrating on green projects at the expense of homeless people. I gather there was a homeless demonstration outside HSBC Bank last week. And there was also a council sleep out where Mr. Ferguson and some of his council cronies actually spent the night sleeping rough.
Well, that shows at least that he cares about...
No, it doesn't. It just proves he's read something in the press, he's got bad press about it, and he wants to make himself look good. So he'll come and sleep outside for the night.
You know, I'm sure if he were here, he'd say, look, I do care about this issue. That's
but
why
he doesn't.
That's why I went out and slept out for the night.
Yeah, but why is it he only wants to talk about his initiative of making Bristol the green capital of Europe 2015. Why is it he's got these 20 mile an hour speed limits, which is slowing the traffic of Bristol to a snail's pace?
Well, actually, but that's the M32 roadworks are slowing.
And
the roadworks in the city centre.
The trouble is, Mr. Ferguson and any independent would only concentrate on the issues that they're concerned about.
Here's one for you. Have you actually got a vote? Because you're living in your car, aren't you?
No. No. I certainly wouldn't vote for George Ferguson.
But you haven't even got a vote. That's interesting, isn't it? I mean, there must be quite a lot of people living in their cars that don't have a vote.
I must admit, I was coming down to meet you tonight, and I saw about 5 to 6 people getting ready to sleep rough in shop doorways. And at 6:30 on a weeknight, that is disgusting.
Can you do me a favour and see if you can get a vote? Because it might be that because you haven't got an address, you can't get somewhere. You know, they won't give you a vote. But you should have a vote. I mean, if you've been evicted, does that mean you're no longer able to vote?
No.
Do us a favour and between now and when we next see you, see if you can get yourself the right to vote. Because if you can't, I mean, it seems to me what's going on here. And I'm sure that this is happening, I mean, certainly in the States this is true, is that they're trying to get poor people and people that haven't got anywhere to live off the voting register so that they don't count anymore.
But the votes go to the incompetent mayor. The votes, if I can't vote, my vote would go to...
No, it doesn't. It's not cast. It's simple as that. There isn't any vote. Anyway, do you think you could do that? See if you can...
Yeah. The only thing I wish I could vote for is the anti-euro vote, you know, when we have our referendum.
Oh, the referendum,
yes.
Yeah.
I'm quite looking forward to that.
See if you can get a vote for that as well. Which way would you vote?
Sorry?
Would you like to tell us which way you'll vote, in or out?
Out. Why should we give the French and the Germans our money?
20 billion a year, isn't it?
Yeah. All them subsidies Airbus won't get. Oh, dear, my heart bleeds forever. Oh dear.
Anyway, oh dear. Ian, it's lovely to talk to you again.
Tony.
Hope to see you again soon with a vote, yeah, and maybe even with somewhere to live. You never know.
Well, I hope the last time I saw you that I'd be telling you good news, but obviously things are still conspiring against me. So, you know, but yes, I live in hope.
Thanks very much, Ian.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And I'm joined now by Jay Dyer, speaking from the US. Whereabouts are you, Jay?
I'm in the southern US, right around Nashville.
Tell us a bit about your background, because you've got actually quite a fairly spectacular blog where you go into a lot of the, psychology of mass media. What's your background?
Well, I did a BA, a Bachelor's of Arts in Philosophy, and then I studied history as well.
Whereabouts?
This is Murray State University, which is actually in Kentucky in the South. I did my graduate work was English and philosophy, and so my thesis work was dealing with the character of Ian Fleming and how he used James Bond as sort of a means not just of telling stories, but also of propaganda. So I talk about semiotics, which is the philosophy of signs and symbols, and how Fleming actually crafted Bond as a multi-tiered, multi-layered usage of propaganda.
Well, many of us, of course, are familiar with the Bond films, particularly here in Britain. What would you say, we ought to know that maybe we don't about Bond?
Well, what most people probably don't know is that the majority of Ian Fleming's stories and works are based on roughly, loosely, real covert operations, or in some sense or some fashion, something relating to, say, the black market or something like that, with, say, Diamonds Are Forever, or to Malthusian policies of population reduction in something like Moonraker. These are all, of course, real things. And even though the films at times differ from the novels, of course, Fleming continued, to work with Saltzman and Broccoli, the producers, for many years, even after the last Fleming story. So what you have there, I think, is a situation of a direct tie between high-level naval psyops, which I don't know about in the UK, but certainly most people in the US are not aware of, Ian Fleming being someone who was involved directly in the special operations executive and things like this, which were high-level covert operations, black operations that were designed at the behest of Western intelligence. So everything from Operation GoldenEye and things like this that were dealing with spying on Francists in Spain up into the Cold War era with essentially designing propaganda. So you have this direct tie-in to Hollywood through characters like Noel Coward or Ian Fleming or Roald Dahl. They're all sort of running in the same circles. And of course, as you mentioned before the show, Dennis Wheatley was also in those same circles. And this is where we have the tie-in to figures like Aleister Crowley being an MI5 asset and things like that. So a lot of those deeper, darker secrets, I think, are probably not known to the public.
Do you think there was in some way that Fleming was trying to tell the public something he couldn't officially tell people because of the Official Secrets Act?
I think so. And of course, this is something spies have done for a long time. You have the secret agent, Joseph Conrad. You can't say in fact, you might get away with in fiction. And so this is a long-standing tradition of people writing reality into spy novels. So I have no doubt that, Fleming, what I read from the biographies that deal with him, like Andrew Lysett and others, is that, I don't think he was a bad guy at all. So I don't think he was intentionally trying to deceive people, but he was certainly sincere in, what he thought was the best policy for, the British Empire and so forth.
One of the things, that tricks which is often played by intelligence agencies, is they actually get people, maybe Fleming even included in this, to do what seem like covert operations for a good purpose, but once the operation's completed, slowly people realise actually this has actually been for a malevolent purpose behind this. Also, you mentioned Dennis Wheatley there. Yes, I mean, he was very much involved in as a deception planner in the Second World War, even though he was a novelist in the run-up to it. And he's on the record as saying that much of what he was writing about after World War II was really based on his experience. I wonder, but you mentioned Crowley there. I mean, Crowley is another thing altogether. He may be. I'm not sure. You tell me. Because he's really seen as the sort of the Antichrist, the 666, this guy who was the most proud to be the most evil man on the planet. How does he fit in?
Well, the idea was that at the time of, as the war was coming to a close, World War II, the idea was, could we in some way create a ruse that might lure Rudolf Hess to come to Scotland? And so this involved Dennis Wheatley, Maxwell Knight, and of course Maxwell Knight is, according to Anthony Masters' thesis in his book, is the basis for the character M. So when you see James Bond getting his orders from M, that's based on Maxwell Knight. And so Wheatley and Knight and Fleming hatched this idea to, you know, maybe utilize Crowley and his skills as a prognosticator, and there's an actual letter from Crowley to the NID, the Special Operations Executive and the NID, to, you know, where he offers up his services. He says, you know, if it's true that Hess is influenced by astrology and magic, my services might be of use to the department. I have the honor to be, sir, your obedient servant, Aleister Crowley. So as to how far this scheme went, I'm not exactly sure. There's a lot of speculation. Many writers have written on this. Richard Spence, Craig Cobble, have dealt with it at length, but the details are still somewhat fuzzy, I guess.
There's another thing in the background of Hess, which is the figure of Martin Bormann, because Hess and Bormann had similar sort of roles as assistants, very close to Hitler, although Bormann was much more involved as a treasurer, keep looking after the money side of things, and they were rivals to a certain extent. And the flight of Hess in 1941 to Britain was rather convenient for Bormann.
Well, and it's interesting you mentioned the notion of predictive programming. There, Peter Fleming, Ian Fleming's brother, who also wrote Pulp Fiction, wrote a book called The Flying Visit, and this was penned before Hess's flight. And in the story, The Flying Visit, it's actually, I think, Hitler who flies over to England to negotiate a truce. So, you know, was this predictive programming? Was this, an actual laying out of a plan? I don't know, but it's interesting nevertheless. But I think that, you know, that's kind of how psychological warfare works. If you profile the person and they have a certain affinity or weakness or proclivity for something like astrology, you could see how that might be useful in luring them into something like, you know, flying to Scotland for a truce.
Interesting as well that there were actually quite a lot of fascists in Britain. I mean, I'm not saying they're not still, there are, but people who were very sympathetic to the Nazi regime, and that was quite a strong faction that, for example, had kept Winston Churchill off the BBC during most of the 1930s.
Well, some people even mention the possibility of covert support from the British, and we know about support from American industrialists like Henry Ford. You know, he wrote a whole treatise on this, supporting Hitler and fascism. So, yeah, there's quite a bit of evidence to suggest support from certain lords and British elite for Hitler and fascism. Absolutely.
Just getting back to Wheatley briefly, because he'd actually wrote a lot about black magic in his... He was well known, really, for writing a book which was made into a film called The Devil Rides Out, which was talked of as the greatest occult novel of the 20th century. I mean, how close do you think novels like that come to the reality behind these cults that Crowley was so involved in? Because Dennis Wheatley did meet Crowley, I think, several times and sort of wined and dined him to get material for his books.
Absolutely. Now, the rumor is, according to Anthony Masters' book, that actually Maxwell Knight and Wheatley were inducted in some sense into, or initiated in some sense, by Crowley. So certainly Wheatley took Crowley's esoteric knowledge serious. I don't know how far Wheatley himself took practicing the occult, but I think that what you see in the novel, you know, might be hyped up a little bit, you know, with Duke de Richelieu, you know, sort of performing a counter magical exorcism of some sorts. That might be hyped up a bit, but you know, the general outline of what's going on here is very accurate.
You mentioned predictive programming as well there. What is this? I mean, because you write about it a lot on your blog, which is jaysanalysis.com. So what is predictive programming? This is, I suppose, something which is, we mentioned briefly there, but it seems to be possibly much more prevalent today in our mainstream media.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of speculation online about this, but I think the best approach, if you really wanted to get a handle on it, would be to look at something like psychological warfare, or to look at the idea of white, black, and gray propaganda. And of course, these are you know, long known techniques of maybe omitting something and putting out information to get a certain reaction, or mixing something true with a lot of falsehood to sort of bend the narrative in a certain direction.
So what's the difference between the white, the black, and the gray?
Well, the white would be the omission, right? So if I put out something something true, but I left out certain details, maybe to cover up who might be involved, and that might be an example of white propaganda. Gray propaganda would be mixing truth with falsehood, like I said, to sort of steer the narrative. And we think about O'Reilly talking about the no spin zone. Well, O'Reilly's show is nothing but a spin zone, right? I mean, that's the whole show. So that might be a good example of that. And then with black propaganda, you would have the idea of outright deception. So perhaps giving the enemy false or misdirection, false direction, or for example, Fleming was involved in a plot to leave papers on a dead soldier that detailed false plans, right? So the Germans then had a misconception as to what Allied plans were based on what they thought were secret plans that were found. So that would be an example of black propaganda. And so essentially what you're doing is just conditioning the thought process of the enemy or the target. And that's what films can do. So they can condition. And I think that's the central role of what we call predictive programming. If anyone wants like an academic treatise on this, there's a famous essay that was in the Journal of Semiotics. It can be found online, and it's called The Semiotics of Media Images from Independence Day and 9/11/2001. So if you remember that cheesy alien invasion film that came out sometime in the 90s with Jeff Goldblum and I forget who, Will Smith, you'll recall that film is all about the destruction of large-scale national monuments, right? And this, I guess on a psychological level, sort of instills the fear of the external threat, right? And this is, you know, the buildup to the in the U.S., at least, the Patriot Act after 9/11 and the war on terror and subsequent foreign invasions. And so this, Professor Elliot Gaines, who wrote this piece, summarizes that essentially what you have is a clear example of a preparation for the created external threat of, you know, bin Laden in Iraq, which was not true, right? We all know about the WMD lies, right? But it provided a pretext because it's the way propaganda and psychological warfare functions is merely to condition and cause a reaction, right? So shut off critical thinking and just bring about an emotional reaction. And so Bush can get on and say, oh, we got to get the terrorists, we're going to go after Saddam, Iraq, right? Which there's no logical link between Saddam Hussein and his Ba'athist party and Al-Qaeda, but regardless, that's the, you know, the U.S. Shock and awe approach, right? So there's a scholarly example from that you can find that actually treats this notion of predictive. Now, it may not use the term predictive programming, but that's what the professor is dealing with in that piece. And so you can expand from there, and what you start to notice is that, well, this is actually a long term thing. This has been going on for a long time. The Department of Defense has long been involved in putting money into Hollywood films all the way back to the 20s and 30s, even before it was called the Department of Defense, back when it was the Department of War. They were involved in specifically having agents in place in Hollywood to make sure that messages that were put into film were crafted in a certain direction. And there have been, you know, many books have been written on this. So the thesis is not one of merely conspiracy theorists, you know, slapping away at keyboards online. It's an actual military tactic, I guess you could say, was the best way to look at it. And then it sort of spills over into mass media, you know, into even mass music, music industry as well. All of these sort of are arms of this same full spectrum dominance approach.
Now, you're talking about the idea of the population as us being targeted, and you know, it almost seems like we're the enemy. We're being targeted by the psychological warfare officers of the maybe perhaps different NATO countries. I noticed just recently, I think maybe 18 months or so ago, Chick Sands in Bedfordshire is where the British psychological warfare people, the British Army, are trained, and there's a new organisation that was set up there called Brigade 77, which immediately makes me think of the 7/7 London bombings. I don't know whether it's just a complete coincidence. But this bothers me when it looks like the mass media is a vehicle to target us, Jay.
Yes, that is the purpose of the mass media. In fact, I would say Hollywood, mass media, they're all kind of arms of the same octopus, and they are psychological warfare. That's what they... I mean, they have other functions as well, you know, obviously monetary gain and, promoting the careers of whoever, whatever, CEOs and so forth. But the primary goal, I think, is, and the reason we know this is that you see a unified agenda across the presentation of most films, especially. And so you do, for example, I mentioned, Independence Day, there's a documentary, Real Bad Arabs, all throughout the 90s up into the early 2000s, you had the presentation of the Arab villain as the essentially the only villain that's out there in the world. And this was, you know, building up to 9/11. Another film like Starship Troopers is treated in Professor Gaines's piece as... tying into the writings of Brzezinski. So the Grand Chessboard came out a few years after Starship Troopers. And again, what do we have? Yes, it's dealing with aliens. And I'm not, you know, the aliens are not the problem. The problem is the creation of the unconscious association of the external threat, right? And that's the point of how fiction can be used in psychological warfare. And this goes all the way back to The Twilight Zone. You can see the early episodes of The Twilight Zone in the credits. They'll talk about how they were created in consultation with the Department of Defense. And a lot of those Twilight Zone episodes dealt with specifically World War II and then Cold War propaganda. So the idea was, oh, the Soviet threats, you know, it's everywhere. Then that transitions into the War on Terror. You know, the external alien threat is just everywhere. They're going to get you. And so you're absolutely right that we're the target. And it goes much deeper than that and darker than that, unfortunately. We think about Michael Aquino, who's a psychological warfare expert in the Army. He's one of the highest specialists in the Army in regard to this, and he wrote a famous piece called Mind War and Psy War, From Mind War to Psy War, right, which deals with how the U.S. needs to transition out of psychological warfare into actually controlling the perception of the populace. Not just targeting the populace for certain buildups to a war and, you know, maybe getting everyone on board, but actually a full spectrum controlling of perception, not just perception of war or politics, but of the entirety of one's worldview, of reality itself. So it's a very wide ranging in scope, and it's subversive, and it is targeted at the population as a whole.
I mean, Brigade 77 in Chick Sands in Bedfordshire in the British Army, they boast that they believe that it's possible to win a war with hardly a shot being fired. I just wonder if you think that they are almost psychologically warfaring, conning themselves. Is that really possible?
Well, I think that goes back to Sun Tzu. Sun Tzu said something to that same effect, that, you know, the real battle is won in the mind, not actually on the field. And if you can get your opponent to acquiesce without killing anybody, then that's even better than losing soldiers. So, yeah, I think that we're unfortunately approaching a kind of dystopian, synthetic reality where everybody's so plugged into, you know, what they read in mainstream sources or see in, you know, mainstream television that, yeah, you could conceivably, this is, you know, this is actually in the film Wag the Dog, right, where they create a whole war that's not real in the Balkans, you know, at the behest of Robert De Niro playing Conrad Breen, the sort of private intelligence / CIA consultant who, you know, gets Dustin Hoffman, playing the sort of director, producer figure in Hollywood, to create a synthetic war. And, you know, how close is that to all the stuff that we've seen with, like, Syrian Danny and things like that, that in my view, are, you know, provocations for situations in Syria or Western support and aid to things like ISIS?
Just before the death of Colonel Gaddafi in Libya, I was looking this up recently, and it's quite clear there was some kind of psychological operation going on there using social media, Facebook and Twitter and things like that, actually in Libya itself. I mean, most people, I suppose, wouldn't have been able to read those languages in this part of the world, so probably wouldn't have been noticing. But just at the point where the kind of final showdown with Gaddafi and the so-called rebels, Al-Qaeda, effectively in Libya was happening, there was a massive campaign on social media put out, I imagine, by you know, our psychological warfare people, saying he's lost, you know, he's gone, and showing even pictures supposedly of Gaddafi being killed, the whole thing having been set up in a scene from a set over in Dubai, of all places. But this kind of wave of defeatism just before the crucial part where Gaddafi may have been able to sort of do something about the insurrection going on in his country, I think is a really good example of how these psychological warfare officers, they would say enhance. I mean, I wouldn't use that word, but, you know, what the troops are doing on the ground. I just wondered, you know, what you make of this military use of psychological warfare, Jay, because I know that there are big private corporations that will actually headhunt former Army psychological warfare officers, people who've been trained by us, by, you know, by the military, by our taxes, and then tap them on the shoulder and say, actually, how would you like to quadruple your salary and come and work for us? We're talking about big companies like Strategic Communications, and these kinds of people that do, I suppose it's like public relations on steroids, to do things, yeah, with things like, we will win an election for you, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head. This was also came out in mainstream news even at the time of the Arab Spring, you know, whatever one's perspective on the Arab Spring is. It was mainstream news that this was all done at the behest of Google. So this so-called revolution is engineered essentially by, I don't remember the name of the guy at the time, but whoever was the head of Google at the time was talking about it openly. So yeah, well, we helped the Arab Spring by promoting it through, you know, Twitter and Facebook. And so, yeah, nowadays that's a big part of psychological warfare, is the whole social media aspect of it. And, you know, the Pentagon, you know, has a big part to play in that. Social media itself is a creation of the intelligence agencies through NQTEL, which is a private CIA company that puts money into things like Google and Facebook. So nothing new there. This has been going on since the beginning of social media. But you're absolutely right that the military is very much interested in this. And then, of course, what you do is that you go from there to private contracting. So you move on to the private corporations. And this is why this kind of work has always been tied into advertising, because that's just essentially what you're doing. Psychological warfare is pretty much advertising. You know, you want to convince the opponent or the target audience that, you know, you've got the goods, you've got, you know, be on our side. And that's exactly what advertising is. And so PR, same thing, political campaigns, working in political campaigns. And it all goes back to psychology. So you're absolutely right. And that is a huge problem in the modern world.
What about today? Because, I mean, one thing you could do potentially with predictive programming is to look at some of the films that are being, you know, on release at the moment and say, hang on a minute, this has got some kind of message in it that maybe almost decode what the military are planning for our future by looking at some of the plot lines in, you know, in Hollywood films.
Right. I think that's possible. If you get really skilled at it. you could conceivably do that. There's actually a movie that deals with that very idea, except it's with novels. Of course, if you remember the Robert Redford film, 3 Days of the Condor, you know, his job as an intelligence analyst was to simply read a bunch of books, read novels all day and look for hidden communiques and, you know, possible plots and so forth that might be embedded, or messages that might be ciphers that might be embedded in literature. So conceivably, yeah, that could be done.
Have you tried it, Jay? Have you had a look at any films over the last, I don't know, 6, 8 months or year or so, and thought to yourself, well, I wonder if this is what the future holds for us?
I guess you risk a lot if you go out and say that you're going to predict the future. But
because that's in a way a flaw, isn't it, in this psychological warfare system, is that it might be that people get so smart that they're not watching films for their entertainment value. They're saying, well, actually, this is what our government is planning to do to us.
Yeah, but I don't think the establishment is too worried about too many people actually doing that. And a lot of times it's mixed in with gibberish and gobbledygook, like aliens and things like that. They're kind of like, you might have the conditioning towards, say, some sort of new technological move or development or something like that. The idea of, say, wearable technology that Bilderberg talked about recently, or microchips, or RFID vitamins or something like this. You might have that, say, in the Bourne films, which the last Bourne film with Jeremy Renner included that idea. But, you know, you've got all this other fictional stuff, you know, the Hollywood stuff that's kind of packaged along with it, that I think leaves most people with the notion that, oh, well, that's fiction. You know, that's, if you were to talk to somebody about the idea of swallowing an RFID vitamin, they would say, well, you're talking Philip K. Dick science fiction stuff. You know, that's not reality. But, you know, this is the world that we're going into, smart cities, right? We're going into this AI grid. And so I think that the mixing it with fiction and the Hollywood elements is what kind of gives it carte blanche. It sort of cloaks it, if you see what I'm saying.
What about, is there an antidote to this? I mean, is there any way to actually watch these films, still enjoy them?
The only antidote is to go to Jay's analysis and to subscribe to my site. I think we have to get back to critical thinking. I don't, most of the public just receives, you know, we're consumers. We're obsessed with consumerism, and we're the same way with information. We just consume it and entertainment. And essentially we live now in a period of infotainment where, you know, the news and everything is all like Hollywood. It's all entertainment. And so that is all premised on not critically thinking. So I always tell people, if you want to start somewhere, I would say basic critical thinking, basic logic. You know, if you learn, say, the basic logical fallacies, you're going to not fall for the majority of, say, advertising scams or propaganda that would be embedded in fictional presentations or in Hollywood.
But, I mean, if you start questioning everything, aren't you going to go crazy?
Well, maybe we need to go crazy. Maybe that's a step in the right direction. I mean, we're already crazy, so we need to step out of being crazy.
Okay, Jay Dyer from jaysanalysis.com. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect. That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast has been broadcast on community radio stations in Bristol, Swindon, Preston and St Albans. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests this week, that's Naya and Habakkuk, talking about St Paul's Carnival and the police. Ian Dumble, who's homeless, and talking also about his trouble with the police too, and his interest in aviation. Finally, Jay Dyer from Nashville, talking about predictive programming and psychological warfare. Thanks also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. Call them on 0117 909 6897 or visit them on the web at prsc.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week, goodbye for now.